Hello and welcome to episode 2 of The Office Block. I'm Paul Dillon, and I want to firstly thank you for the response to episode 1. We had a great deal of feedback, not least in our Facebook poll, where 84% of you said that they would not trust their employer with their data. This episode takes up where the last one left off, but first some housekeeping. Please remember to add us on Facebook and Instagram. You'll find us at The Office Block, and follow us on Twitter, TheOBSTweets. On this show, we're looking at your rights in relation to your data in the workplace and how digitalisation and AI are impacting on work and finance. We'll be chatting to Dr. Larry Stapleton about the future of banking and how working banking and financial services is evolving. We'll also be joined by Dr. Christina Colclough from the Uni Global Union. Academics Lisa Wilson from the Nevin Institute and Michelle O'Sullivan from UL will join our panel to discuss these issues and more. But first, I want to bring you this interview with Dr. Larry Stapleton from WIT, who sat down with Garrett Murphy at the FSU conference.
I'm delighted The Office Block is down in Limerick today at the Financial Services Union's conference. And with me here today is Dr. Larry Stapleton, Director of NewFutures.com and academic in Waterford Institute. You're very welcome to join us, Larry.
Great to be here, Gareth. Thanks for inviting me.
You are a specialist in the interplay between human factors and digital systems. That has to be a massive area of growth today. Can you explain to our listeners what that means, human factors and digital systems?
Well, think about what's been going on in the last few months. We've had, in some of the banks, a serious failure on the technology front, which has had a really bad impact on the customers, and it's been human beings, staff in banks, who've been out there trying to fix it. And as Dermot Ryan mentioned in his article on this back in the end of April there, the new General Secretary of the FSU, he talked about the human face of banking and the need to focus on the human view and human perspective when dealing with customers and regulators and so on within the banking sector. And that's really where the human factors comes in. Having a technology-centred view is a very narrow and limiting view and a very narrow and limited understanding of what banking can actually deliver to society. A human factors view tries to counterbalance a much broader range of issues in one coherent approach, what we call joint design of systems. So in this approach, which we call a human-centred systems as opposed to a technology-centred systems approach, sometimes called a socio-technical system, sorry for the technical jargon there, but it refers to the combination of social and technical. What we try to do is balance four main dimensions. One dimension is the design and development of appropriate tasks that need to be done, the design and development and growth and maturing of an organizational culture that can support the kind of work that needs to be done. Of course, the technology infrastructure underneath, and most important of all, the people themselves who have needs, who have objectives, who have values, and who have careers. And how do we pull all that together into a single system and balance it out?
So it isn't technology for technology's sake. You think technology should actually be developed for and by humans to complement work as opposed to replace work.
Exactly. And that and enabling people to get their jobs done as opposed to, in some cases, actually getting in the way of people getting it. And I know some of your listeners will know what I'm talking about, how technology can actually get in the way of trying to get one's work done. And one manager once described it to me as the tail wagging the dog. Where the technology tail is wagging the people dog or the organizational dog, and the only outcome there is the dog gets a headache.
Would you have any fear that technology in banking, I'm thinking of particularly of, say, lending algorithms or artificial intelligence being behind some lending decisions that might take place in banking, would you have any fear that that could potentially lead to more bubbles, bursts and crisis that we've seen in recent years?
I think the history of computing in areas associated with financial services has been very spotty. If you go way back to 1987 to the crisis in Black Wednesday and so on, computers were, and new computer algorithms were central to some of what happened in that crash, where there were automated decisions being made, which were really inappropriate, as it turned out. Because, as I said, the world is a messy place, and decision-making in this complex world in which we live needs to take into account a very wide range of risk factors, and sometimes these technologies are far too narrowly focused to be able to manage that. In some other sectors, for example, in railway engineering, in aviation, they're now beginning to look at the risk and regulatory frameworks in a much more comprehensive and complex way, which includes both leadership style and organizational culture as part of what gets regulated, because of the complex interplay between human factors and technologies, which is not always taken into account in a technology-centered view.
What major required changes would you say in leadership style? You mentioned leadership style as being necessarily complementary if technology is going to work. What major changes would you say are required today?
What the banks are looking at in the rollout of a lot of these technologies is they're looking for a more innovative workforce, a more creative workforce who can come up with more innovative solutions. This requires a more collaborative approach to how banking is delivered, and that requires a leadership style that complements a more collaborative approach, in which staff are going to be empowered to make more decisions autonomously. So in such an environment, a command and control approach, top-down approach, tends not to work very well, because you can't respond quickly enough. Innovators need autonomy to make decisions. So what the leadership style that is often cited in this context is what we call level 5 leadership. This is what Jim Collins calls it, sometimes called servant-oriented leadership. But the idea would be that the senior leadership team really have two functions. One function is to set an appropriate culture for the organization in which workers can actually get their work done in as motivated, enthusiastic employees. But on the other hand, also, in line with the culture, to also get rid of the barriers that block workers and staff trying to get their job done in an appropriate way, including trying to find each other to put together teams, this sort of thing. So the leadership style is really critical and needs to change alongside the organizational culture if the technology is going to work in the way that we're hoping it will.
Okay, so less command and control, less top down,
yeah.
More teamwork.
More a leadership style which is much more facilitative.
Okay, do you see that in any way contradicting? Because certainly there are many people who would say work has become more individualized and more command and control and do what you're told, and I set you these 3 tasks and I just want you to repeat them quicker and more often. So in some ways it's not going the direction you suggest it needs to. Do you think that's a fair comment?
I think it's a real challenge that we face, and it's a broader challenge, not just within our organisations, but in society generally, in which even human relationships are becoming more and more fragmented. Things are becoming more and more what we might call micro. So if we look at tasks, we can imagine a world in which the tasks that workers are performing in organisations like banks might become more and more routinised, more and more smaller and smaller and smaller, with a view to having them automated later. And I think that's a risk. I think that we need legislation around this. We need to understand what is it to be an employee in a world in which maybe we're moving towards more and more piecework. But certainly on the regulatory side, I know in other sectors, there's real concerns about the levels of complexity that digital technology raises up in terms of decision making, not just around customers, but around hazardous situations. And this really requires a rethink of what we when we think about regulation. What do we mean by risk?
Can it be regulated if it is that complex? And if technology seems to be almost a step ahead of the central bank and ahead of regulators, do you think it can actually be successfully regulated?
Well, I think there's two parts to it. One part is the technology itself and what. And the ethics are behind the development of technology. And then the second part is the organizational cultural settings and the human factors within our organizations that are deploying the technology. So let's take the first one. I agree with Christina Kolkloff very strongly on this, and I think her work is amazing in the UNI and we need to pay a lot more attention to it. Her whole idea of the ethical principles are behind AI and AI development, and she set that out very clearly. Within IFAC, there has been a move a few years back, but we need to revisit it, around looking at a Hippocratic Oath type situation like you have in medicine for technology developers. Recently, Dermot Ryan put a challenge down to digital innovators, in which he challenged innovators to develop technologies for the benefit of society and the people who work in our organizations, not just to make a pile of money and to shift more and more wealth from the poor to the rich. So he's put that challenge down. I think that challenge needs to be taken seriously. And one part of that might be for large organizations like the IEEE, IFAC, and these organizations, which are international global federations of systems engineers and technology workers, to start to promote the idea of something like a Hippocratic Oath, to really take seriously the challenges around Christina Kolkloff's principles of ethical AI and other developments.
So technology for a common good, so to speak, kind of approach is what's necessary.
I think the technology being developed in a technocentric way is really inappropriate.
Okay.
I think the technology is in this, as you say, is in the service of all humanity, and it should not be there to make life worse for everybody and just a small few benefit. On the other hand, I think we need to also recognize the wonderful opportunities that come with the new technologies, wonderful opportunities around flexible working arrangements, more interesting work. If we can get these technologies to take over the routine, boring kind of work that not all of us want to do, and free up human beings to do what they're really great at, which is handling complexity, ambiguity, messy problems. I think I'm not a Luddite about this. I think there's really great tech out there and we should embrace it. But we should embrace it in a socially responsible way, as we've discussed.
Okay, you've looked more specifically, I think, at banking in a digital age. What would you say is the biggest challenge that technology and digitalization in banking presents for workers themselves more specifically, and how do you think actually workers can respond to that effectively?
Yeah, I think that when you're talking about banking in the digital age, and that was a program that we put together in the Institute of Banking. We designed it 2014-15, launched it in 2015, and the whole idea of that program, which is an honors degree program, was to help people to get their heads around the challenges and opportunities that arise in this digital technology space in the financial sector. What a lot of our students are surprised about when they come on the program is how little of the technical work we do. We do review the technologies, we do get into the tech, but the really big issues are what we've discussed today. They're the social issues, they're the organized, and from within banks, they're going to be organizational cultural issues and leadership style, and that there's a good synergy and alignment between appropriate leadership styles and management styles, appropriate systems of work, including digital technology, and appropriate organizational culture. The organizations that get that right, we know, will be tremendously successful. The organizations that don't get it right are going to get into real difficulty.
And how set do you think are Irish banks to take on that challenge?
I think they're trying. I think that the fact that we've got Banking in the Digital Age program, which is supported heavily by the Irish banks, does indicate an openness and understanding that something needs to change. But I think there's real challenges. One of the obvious challenges is rebuilding trust in banking in general in Ireland. I would see the new digital paradigm and the shifts that we're talking about as a wonderful opportunity for Irish banking to not just rebuild trust, but to show real leadership in terms of new ways of working and new ways of engaging with customers and engaging with communities, rural communities, for example. I think Ireland is sort of unique in its penetration into rural communities. And sitting here in the conference on the 100th anniversary of the Union has got me thinking a lot about the last 100-150 years of banking in Ireland and how embedded it's been in community. And if we lose sight of that at the altar of digital technology, that would be, I think, a mistake.
Dr. Larry Stapledon, it's been fantastic to have you on the Office Block. I really appreciate it. And we're now going to return to our host, Paul Dillon, in studio.
So we're joined on the phone by Christina Kolkloff. You're welcome onto the show, Christina.
Thank you very much.
Christina, you were down at the Financial Services Union Conference in Limerick last weekend. There was a very, very positive and engaged response to what you were saying. One of the things you were talking about is a Future World of Work initiative. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, you know, UniGlobal Union, already back in our Congress in 2014, tabled a motion on the future of work. And this was very much General Secretary Philip Jennings, who had seen that this is going to become a really hot and important topic that we engage in. So since then, Philip especially has been driving the work that we have been doing, has gotten engaged on all levels of politics and companies on this. And then he brought me on board a couple of years ago to work with him and work with the whole organization and drive this forward. So the futurewilderwork.org is our website, and you can all go in there and see the activities we're doing, the stories, our documents and things that, that you know, podcasts and so on.
Excellent.
I've
gone through the website. Very, very interesting. I encourage everybody listening to do so as well. In a nutshell, Christina, can you tell us what are the biggest challenges digitalization puts up to workers?
I think that, I mean, there's several big ones. One of them is that we actually start to figure out what is myth and what is truth in what is happening. There's a lot of fear-mongering going on. Oh, you know, 50% of all jobs will be lost and so on. The robots are coming and all of that. And then on the other hand, there's also a fear of complacency, a danger of complacency, i.e. we do nothing, we don't really care. So it's about us finding our way as unions through this in determining what are our demands in relation to job changes, job displacements, skills, our institutions, our government institutions, what needs changing. But we really need to sit down at the table and put our demands down now.
You mentioned how workers might respond to shape those events. What would a process look like where workers would begin to respond to the digitalization that's impacting their jobs?
If you take a bunch of workers in a bank, for example, they are all talking now, and I could hear that as well at your Congress, about this increasing monitoring of them, of the data, of the importance of data. So I would sit around, you know, with a bunch of colleagues in your local union club and say, listen, what society do we want? Everything is in principle possible. The robots could come. We could all lose our jobs. But what demands do we want to data, to artificial intelligence, to our rights and access to skills, upskilling and reskilling, and then put together a portfolio of demands.
Michelle, I just want to bring you in on that. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, I totally agree with Christine about the idea of examining myth versus reality about digitalization and the fear-mongering that can go on. I mean, there's a lot of disagreement in literature and research about the extent to which digitalization and AI and so on will impact on jobs. Christine mentioned the statistic that has been around for the last couple of years, particularly from American study, which said that almost half of American jobs which would be lost to digitalization and automation. But we've had contrasting ones since, particularly by the OECD, which say that actually only about probably 9% of tasks completed by people are at high risk of automation. So there's widely differing predictions as to the extent to which digitalization and automation is going to impact on jobs. But as Christine mentioned, I would welcome the idea that whatever comes the future, because it is a bit of betting, if you like, as to and guesswork as to what can happen, is that people do decide, well, whatever goes on around us, we do have a particular set of needs that have to be met through work.
Yeah. And when we look at where our industry might go and how jobs might develop, Christina, how do you feel about that debate? How do you feel jobs are likely to evolve? What's the balance between technology as a force for good in society and that fear of that mass displacement?
Well, just want to firstly say that I totally agree with what Michelle just said, and that we must start looking at the tasks that we do that compromise a job right now. So in the response to your question here, how might things develop? I think the answer to that question is very much, I would say, that depends on how much ethical and responsible behavior that we can assume and expect from our governments, but also our companies. And with that, I mean that technology can be really good. Some of these digital tools can be really good also for us. But it depends on how they are deployed, for what reason they are deployed. And with that, I mean, if it's only to cut costs, well, then I would say, well, are we producing ourselves to hell?
Yeah. One of the issues, Christina, that you spoke about at the weekend was data in the workplace and workers' rights over their own data. Is that something that you'd like to expand upon? Because it's something that we're hearing a lot of in terms of the context of GDPR and that debate. You know, should we be concerned about our relationship with our employers vis-a-vis our data?
Absolutely. I cannot say that more firmly. Concerned, well, yeah, but we should absolutely be involved. We should understand how companies are using data. We must ask what type of data. Is it personal data they're mining on us from the outside, buying from third companies, so-called data brokers? Are they evaluating us, our performance, and so on this data? And how can we engage in a dialogue with the managers and say, listen, let's work on this together. Let's make sure we have a data council, that we have ethical dimensions to this, that we're very transparent around the use of data, yeah, the selling of data, the handling of it.
Yeah. Just bring you in there on that, Michelle. How do you feel workers should respond to those concerns about data? Should they approach employers? Should they contact a trade union? What are the correct responses to those concerns?
Yeah, well, I mean, probably a trade union is usually a first port of call for any workplace issue. I think it speaks to not just a data issue, but a workplace issue. And in the last podcast that you had Dr. Deirdre Curran talking about voice in the workplace and people needing a say. So all of this goes back to, if we're going to challenge the way in which employers use data, well, that has to start from employees having to have a mechanism by which they voice their concerns. And of course, it's always better if they can do that collectively, because once someone has to do it in an individual manner, they are slightly isolated, and there's no guarantee that even if they get a good outcome from that individual issue, that it's going to be spread across the workplace. So there should be collective mechanisms for people to express their opinion on a range of workplace issues, which include obviously data protection, because it is extremely important. And we're seeing now a lot of, even in mainstream news, companies promoting the use of data monitoring, particularly, for example, in the United States. I read one last week where you have a company which is developing technology where they attach microphones to employees' ID cards and ID badges, and they collect the information from their general conversations, their movement around the office, how much their time they're spending with different people in the office, and then feeding that data back in the name of efficiency.
Yeah.
But of course, that's a highly intrusive set of data monitoring.
Christina, just bring you in there on that. How would you feel about what Michelle has just been saying there in terms of that intrusion into people's data?
No, I mean, certainly. I mean, we must see data rights as being equivalent as privacy rights, as our fundamental rights. And, you know, we have stories from all sorts of different sectors now where employees, they don't even have time to go to the toilet because every movement they make, every arm stretch they take is being measured. We have an example from a bank in Texas right now, where some of these systems are being used in the call center, and employees or workers are paid according to what the software judges them. Are they saying thank you six times and so on? The only problem is that this software does not recognize female voices as well as men's, or ethnic minorities as well as the white man. So, you know, that's a huge problem. So we really have to be concerned about this.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And one of the things that I've heard you speak about and write about before, Christina, is how HR departments might use data. Can you just expand a little bit about that for our listeners?
Well, you will see more and more in newspaper articles and so on, this concept of management by algorithm. And with that, it raises a big question, is all of this data taking the human out of human resources? So we have examples from all over the world now where artificial intelligence, i.e. algorithms, are being used in recruitment processes, so to automatically sift through the applicants and sort them in different piles. This is now being done by an algorithm. But of course, another consequence of that is that all of your data, all of your information suddenly becomes data, suddenly becomes available. What do you know about how it's being used after you've applied for the job? It's also being used in promotion processes in companies, in disciplining workers, or ultimately in firing. So this whole management by algorithm is something we have to pay attention to and object to when it is used as a way for management to avoid their responsibility.
Christina, one of the interesting things is that a lot of HR jobs themselves are potentially very vulnerable to new ways of technology evolving.
Yep.
I mean, there's a certain irony in that, I suppose. But
that's I think it's important what you're saying there, but I actually think that what you're also saying is a lesson that we have to realise. You know, every time we take an Uber, every time we use an Airbnb, or we do a click task, or we get somebody to deliver our pizzas via Deliveroo or whatever, we have to realize that when we use these tasks, we're also legitimizing that form of work. So what goes around comes around. And in that sense, okay, this was HR and they can be automated, but a lot of our jobs, a lot of our tasks, as Michelle said, can be automated. So, you know, let's you know, really realize that we are not protected or shielded in any way, and therefore we have to act responsibly also in our actions outside of work.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very valid point. I mean, you know, even to go as far as Christine was saying about what goes around comes around. I mean, you do have research now into, like she was mentioning, Airbnb and so, where the general public as well are becoming part supervisors of employees. So if you have frontline employees at restaurants or cinemas or hotels or whatever, and of course, because we're so used to now giving feedback on websites about our experiences in these places, management are using this data. So now you have this 360 degrees for its fancy name of feedback, real-time feedback. And of course, an employee has very little control of that feedback from the public. And there's no opportunity for an employee really to be able to challenge something that someone from the public might say. So we're all engaging in somebody else's performance review as well.
Indeed. Dr. Christina Colcliffe, Director of Platform and Agency Workers, Digitalisation and Trade. Thank you very much for joining us on The Office Block. It's been a real pleasure to have you live on the phone.
Thank you, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Talk to you again. Thank you, Christina. So for our panel, we're joined by Lisa Wilson. Lisa is an economist with the Nevin Economic Research Institute. Her main research areas include economic distribution, poverty, public expenditure, living standards and well-being. Hi, Lisa.
Hiya.
And Michelle O'Sullivan is still with us. And Michelle, your expertise is primarily on precarious work with particular attention on wage setting and public policy in low-wage jobs. So we've had a listen to our interview with Larry Stapleton conducted by Gareth Murphy of the Financial Services Union at the FSU conference. Just want to bring you in first, Lisa. How would you respond to that interview? What do you think? Was Larry on the money with that, or where was he going?
Yeah, I think some of the things that Larry was saying in terms of, you know, how we should let technology influence us and how we kind of should engage with technology in terms of the technological change in the labour market. I think, yes, he was on the money in terms of some points that we need to, you know, we do have power in terms of how we shape and kind of change in terms of the impact the technological change is going to have on us. And of course, technological change is going to be a force of disruption, and undoubtedly it will change how we work, what we work on, and the skills that are required to do our work. And for sure that will happen. And I suppose, yeah, agreeing with what Larry says, and I think in our current discussions, that kind of the impact, you know, of the technological change, the impact that it's going to have, there isn't enough attention being paid to that. Yes, we can shape this, and we need to give more importance to the kind of the human interaction and the human interventions that we can have, I suppose.
Fairly ambitious concepts that Larry had in terms of technology for the common good, technology for all humanity. It's hard sometimes to think about how people might actually shape technology in that way.
Technology is good, and you know, I think, you know, what I would respond to that is its implementation of technology is key. And I think, I suppose, we are hearing a lot about kind of technology and kind of, you know, the risks that all our jobs are going to be automated and kind of we're going to reach the apocalypse where all the robots are going to come and, you know, we need to strap into our seats because the worst is going to happen. And I can understand where this fear is coming from. There is headlines in the newspapers, TV programs, and I don't know how many kind of online tools where you go on and, you know, kind of put in, you know, this is my job, this is what I do. And the computer will tell you, you know, your likelihood that your job is going to be lost to a robot or automated. But, you know, that's kind of paradoxical in itself. But some of these reports are predicting that the risk that, you know, kind of everyone or kind of certainly a large majority of people will lose their job to automation. But it is important to remember that the methodologies applied and kind of the background to estimate the number of jobs that are going to be lost. So kind of for Northern Ireland, we've had some work coming out recently, which is saying, you know, half of jobs in Northern Ireland are going to be lost to automation over the next 10 years. And, you know, 500,000 jobs and very scary numbers. And of course, there is kind of some reason to be concerned about this. But I do think, yes, that certainly technology can be used to the common good to some extent because it can have benefits and it will bring benefits. But I think the important thing is how it is applied. And what we're seeing at the minute, I suppose, is that a lot and where the kind of impact that technology is going to come first is kind of in the kind of middle jobs, so the people in the middle of our labour market, mid-skilled people, and we're kind of going to see a growth of the higher skilled people and the lower skilled people. And what we're seeing particularly at the minute is the particular growth of people at the low skilled. So yes, that would cause concern that, you know, this isn't for the common good, because technology has having a negative effect and pushing people downwards and kind of, you know, this is having a negative impact on their living standards. But we do have power and we can fight back against that and, you know, fight as much as we can to make sure that technology does work for the common good and does kind of bring benefits to all. And this is not just a conversation that is, you know, for business and technologists to kind of influence how this is going to happen. I think, yes, trade unions can play a key role here. And, you know, it hasn't happened yet. It's happening. And we need to continue to fight to make sure that it does benefit the common good.
Michelle, you're scribbling furiously there.
Yeah, I think similar in terms of Larry's interview. He raised a lot of really interesting points. I mean, Lisa referred to, you know, the scaremongering that can go on about these jobs. I mean, if you look at the early 20th century, you can go on YouTube and watch clips of Charlie Chaplin's old movie The Machine, where he acts out someone in a factory who's literally eaten by a machine. So we've, you know, people have always had these fears for the last 100 years about the impact of technology. And of course, Charlie Chaplin's clip makes a very valid point about the extent to which technology and machines control the workers versus the other way around, and to what extent can they control not just what we do, but how we do it?
Yeah.
And particularly in the last podcast as well, there was mention by Deirdre Curran from NUIG about the intensity of work.
Yeah.
And I think this is something where technology can be a challenge for workers because it can increase the intensity of work. And there has been research showing that the intensity of work in European countries, many European countries, has increased in the last 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
So that is a continuing concern for workers in all sectors. You know, Lisa's right about the issue that particularly research does seem to suggest that people at lower skills and lower education levels might be at higher risk of having their tasks automated. And therefore, then the challenge then for the state is that, you know, people are trained in such a way as to not be adversely affected by the changes.
And what about the challenge for employers, Michelle? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, if we are moving... If new jobs are being created, different types of jobs are being created, can we talk about employers having an obligation in terms of training and skilling and investing in those skills for staff whose jobs might be at risk in terms of automation or digitalization?
Yeah, well, I think there's two issues there. I mean, first of all, I think there's still... has to be a recognition, or there may need to be a recognition, or at least a discussion about the impact of technology, because there was a survey done in the last 2 years amongst 18,000 employers in 40 countries, and the majority of employers in that survey felt that technology would have no impact on headcount in the medium term, and another 20% felt that it would increase jobs, and the remaining that would decrease jobs. So I don't think it's yet clear amongst employers as to what the effect of technology would be on the workforce. But I think regardless of the technology, I think then there's the separate discussion about the obligation on employers. Mm. And the issue of the ethics and ethical technology was mentioned. And I mean, it doesn't have to be about technology. There's ethical jobs, mm. you know. And,
but are there ethical employers?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's linking to you know, where this is going, I suppose, that, you know, ethical jobs are supposed to be ones where they contribute to workers and society. And therefore, there's an obligation on employing organisations to ensure that those that jobs that are created are ethical ones, because yeah. they should have some positive contribution to society and workers' well-being.
Lisa, can I just bring you in for a moment, because I've read a lot of your research and in terms of mm-hmm. Your work on the future of the economy in the north of Ireland. Can you just maybe mm-hmm. add your voice to that discussion about the obligation in particular of employers towards workers and towards, you know, the future of their own companies? Because I yes, go on, yeah.
And I suppose, yeah, I could come in and say business knows that workers are their greatest assets. But I suppose the point about it is that we have created a kind of institutional kind of industrial structure where cost cutting is a kind of key goal here. So cost cutting is the way that people seek to do business these days, cutting costs. And I suppose in terms of how this then will influence, you know, the impact on the future of work or potential automation is that we're seeing large numbers of our people, of our workforce, both in the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, who are low-skilled and low-skilled jobs. And they're low paid, they're working precarious employment conditions. But I think what business needs to recognise is that high-skilled workers are more productive. They need to realise that, yes, workers are their key assets. High-skilled workers are the innovators. They have the skills to develop forward a business. And this kind of emphasis on cutting costs and cutting wage costs isn't the most productive thing for a business. And it's certainly worrying whenever you look at some of the evidence in terms of, if you ask people in terms of, you know, have they been getting training and work, and has their level of skill used, improved or progressed over a period of time? Has a variety of tasks they've been performing been varying over time and kind of becoming more skilled? Large proportions of our workforce aren't seeing these progressions. And this is certainly worrying in terms of, for businesses, from the point of view that these are the things that are going to bring innovations and more productivity and at the end of the road, more profit for the businesses. But we're seeing maybe 40% of our workforce haven't seen any progression over the past 5 years in the level of skill that they've used in their jobs. So they're not getting on the job training. They're not being upskilled. And then certainly, you know, if we are going to move to this future where, you know, the future is all going to be robots and computers and automated jobs, we're going to need a more skilled workforce where humans and workers are going to be able to work alongside these robots. Because I think it's just fantasy to try and imagine this world, you know, that suddenly, you know, you arrive at our work desks one day and there will be no jobs for us, you know, the robots will have taken over. And I think, you know, the people who kind of spout that argument are kind of being extreme from both ends. I think certainly in the medium term, but I would say also in the long term, the impact of robots and automation and kind of the nature of the future work is going to be seeing humans working alongside robots. This kind of notion of cobotics, kind of humans cooperating with robots. And that will require a skilled workforce. Mm-hmm. And so the impetus becomes for business to upskill their workforce, because that will bring them the greatest benefits.
Michelle, can I just bring you in on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, skills is extremely important. I think one of the probably concerning issues for a country like Ireland is the extent to which this idea of upskilling becomes solely the focus of the employee's responsibility. Mm. And therefore that, you know, it feeds into this idea or discourse, if you like, that we're all our own masters of destiny. We're all our own entrepreneurs. It's our responsibility to upskill and so on. And therefore that it detaches responsibility from anybody else. And of course, upskilling and retraining has significant societal advantages because, you know, as Lisa was mentioning, if the focus of organisations is to cut costs and so on, well, that's not much good to business at the end of the day if there's not demand from people who are are in good paid jobs to be able to buy the products or the services that businesses want to begin with.
It would seem to me that we are going in the opposite direction at the moment. We have a growth in lower wage jobs. We have a growth in lower skilled jobs. We have a very genuine fear on the part of many people that their jobs will disappear altogether. And I don't see a response from many employers and indeed from the government in terms of saying, well, let's invest in workers to make sure that people are available to get the next generation of high-skilled, secure jobs.
Well, I think there has been some positive development in that, you know, the government is moving to try and increase the National Training Fund and the employer's obligations into the National Training Fund, even it's still at a low level. I mean, I think what we don't have is a system, for example, like in Denmark, where colleagues such as Colin McLaughlin, UCD, have spoken about this in the past, where they have a much more coordinated, integrated model between trade unions, employers and the state in terms of skills and training. So if you consider, for example, a lower skilled, low paid job, that unions will have negotiated with employers that those people will have time off to be able to do state training or education or upskilling, and that is part paid for then by the state training fund. But it is a virtuous circle in which all these parties are involved towards the same goal of trying to maintain standards. We don't have that virtuous circle in Ireland, so therefore it can often fall back on people to be individuals to be able to upskill themselves. And I suppose I know because I teach a lot of people who work full-time jobs and then come in at night into the university and train, and some of them find it quite difficult to get time off work just to be able to come to attend courses, even if it's of benefit to the immediate industry or firm that they're working in. So there is challenges there in terms of trying to sometimes convince employers in very competitive industries that there is a benefit to employees upskilling.
Lisa, just bring you in on that point.
Mm-hmm. Yes, certainly I would agree with you, Paul, in terms of, you know, it kind of seems that we're going in the other direction. And we certainly kind of see, I suppose, some evidence of this when we're looking at the, what does the future look like? You know, we're going to need high-skilled workers, high-skilled workers tend to be working in environments where they do get on-the-job training, and they, you know, kind of this continual professional development, continual upskill and recognition of the importance that investing in your staff will have. And yes, we are definitely seeing evidence that with the increase in kind of temporary, precarious, insecure job contracts and part-time positions, is that these are the type of workers who are less likely to be invested in. And they're less likely to bring innovation to the table of your business. They're less likely, because they're going to be there, you know, for a shorter period of time. They're going to carry knowledge from, you know, their current job into the next job, and kind of you don't get this growth of knowledge, insider knowledge in your business. So this brings negative effects for businesses, and I don't think that there's a kind of a realization of the kind of longer term innovation costs that this has for employers, because as I said, the focus at the minute is on short term cost cutting, cutting costs via wages and kind of, you know, via less investment in staff in the short term, rather than kind of looking at over the longer term and what, in terms of what's going to bring longer term benefits. And we know that is investment in staff is key to that.
Yeah, and I think that feeds in with comments that Larry Stapleton made earlier about having, you know, technology used in a socially responsible way. And he talked about leadership and giving autonomy to workers and so on, because, you know, apart from the issue of difficulties and challenges for low skilled or lower paid jobs, there are challenges common to all employees in either in high or low skilled, and particularly in the area of job demands, where people are in demanding jobs in terms of emotional demands, in terms of tight deadlines, heavy workloads. Richard Grogan mentioned the idea of being, you know, on duty practically all the time. So, for example, I mean, financial services is a sector where this is particularly problematic. I mean, there was a workplace behaviour study done recently between NUIG and UL, where they found that financial services employees had the second highest reported levels of experience of unreasonable management, which is basically around the idea of not feeling feeling they had enough managerial support and having a lot to do and not enough time or resources to do it in. So we have discussions about the low skilled, if you like, the more precarious end of jobs. But then we have all these other jobs which are, you know, on paper, very good jobs.
Yeah.
But work intensity and demands makes them very challenging as well. And that's something which technology can also be used in a ways to add to that unreasonableness as well.
Yeah, yeah. Just to take a point that Larry made, and we were, I was thinking about it there, just in terms of management and the effect of management techniques in the workplace. Larry was talking about technology perhaps opening up opportunities for more autonomy at work. Would that read in reality what's happening out there, Michelle?
It's very difficult to say. I mean, there are European-wide surveys which suggest that, you know, autonomy hasn't necessarily gotten worse, you know, in terms of people's jobs, but that there are other issues in terms of maybe their work-life balance, job security, working hours. So they're all very important issues. Even the basic things like, for example, the amount of time that we spend commuting. I mean, Ireland has one of the highest levels of commuter time for employees, which of course adds to the pressures of work as well. But we know from all the research that autonomy and the greater amount of control that people have over the jobs, the better that they feel about their jobs, the better they feel the way in which they can do their jobs as well. But that is becoming increasingly difficult, because although there's a lot of talk in HR circles about empowerment and so on, for a lot of people the reality is that empowerment is a word, and that very much that command and control model is still in place, perhaps just under different names.
Yeah. Okay, well, Lisa, do you want to come in on that?
I just want to go back to one of the points that Michelle made earlier in terms of, you know, the value of this kind of human interaction or kind of human intelligence of workers. And I think that is something that is increasingly going to start being recognised, because this kind of human creative intelligence, human and emotional intelligence, is increasingly being recognised by business and, you know, in the retail sector and even in the financial sector, is something that is, it's not possible to automate, and it's very difficult, and these are very important skill sets. And we're even seeing evidence now in the retail sectors where some, you know, after trial and of automated systems, the decision is made to move back to using humans, because the people are using services these days as to pay for the experience, and the human interaction, the human intelligence and the engagement is a very important part of using the service. So, but I think there's a lack of recognition still, but I think this is starting to grow, that this is a skill. These human intelligence are skills that we need to value, and we need to monopolise on the value of these.
Yeah. Dr. Lisa Wilson, thank you for joining us from Belfast. We appreciate you coming on the show. And thank you very much, Michelle, for joining us in studio.
No problem. Thank you.
Before we finish up the show, just like to ask you to subscribe to us on iTunes or the audio platform of your choice. If you like the show, please leave a review. Check out theofficeblock.org for articles and content on this show, and drop us a line with any feedback, opinions or ideas for future guests. We'd really appreciate if you could subscribe at theofficeblock.org. We want to thank everyone at the Financial Services Union, the head stuff here, for hosting us. And finally, please vote in our poll, which is now live on our Facebook. Reports show that employers' use of monitoring, measuring technology and also communication tools are increasing work-related stress. Smartphones and devices mean workers are constantly online and in communication with work, and this is leading to stress, burnout and a worsening of the work-life balance. Do you feel your employer's use of technology is causing you stress? Please vote on our poll, which is live now on our Facebook page. Until next time, thanks for listening, and please get in touch and spread the word about The Office Block, the online space for people working in finance.